Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and to the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter and a gastronaut. Now, I have in my hand here, I don't know if you can hear it there, but a small handful of yellowish, sort of light brown yellowish, they clearly look like peas or beans. Look like beans. I'm going to just crush them in my hand like that to give them a little bit of a starter. And when you crush them, the little kind of crispy sort of seed coatings come off. And underneath is a light green bean. Now, if I bite that light green bean, well, first of all, I might lose a tooth because it's really, really hard. But also, there's absolutely nothing to it. There's no flavour whatsoever. So you kind of think, why would you ever bother to do anything with this? Well, what we're going to do is, I've got a little blowtorch here. So here's my blowtorch. Okay, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to roast a bean. Now, it just sort of burns it a little bit, chars it around the outside. And as it begins to heat up, it browns, it's expanding a little bit, and it's looking a little bit oily on the outside, and it's got a little sheen to it, but also already here in my little studio, there's this extraordinary smell. Okay, I think that'll probably do the trick, just a tiny little bit. So I've just sort of browned it a little bit, it's got a beautiful glisten to it. Now let's have a little look at it. I'm going to have a smell of this bean. Okay, so already there is the most extraordinary set of complex flavours that are, to me, are quite magical. And they're sort of musky, they're spicy, sort of chocolatey. I mean, all sorts of different things going on. So it's pretty obvious that what I've got here is a coffee bean. Now, once a coffee bean has been roasted, you get coffee. It's a heady blend of flavour chemistry and psychoactive mind-altering drugs. But it's also packed with culture and history and cash. It's a $460 billion market. There's even been an espresso machine used on the International Space Station. Now, to discuss one of the most interesting food and drink stories of them all, I'm joined by Professor Jonathan Morris. Jonathan is Vice President of the Royal Historical Society, Professor of Modern History at the University of Hertfordshire, and he's the author of Coffee, A Global History. He also co-hosts the History of Coffee podcast series. Jonathan, it's a real pleasure to have you.
Oh, it's great to be here, Stefan. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Oh, that's fantastic. So first of all, I think we really need to start by saying, what is your favourite type of coffee? How many have you had already today? It's 10 past 10 in the morning. Have you had a coffee and how did you have it?
Yeah, I have had coffee. I had a French press, which is what I use always in the morning. I had a French press with some coffee from Rwanda. And actually, I gave myself the privilege of an espresso chaser today, which came from Peru.
And what if you had to choose your favourite coffee brew or even the favourite experience of coffee from your massive experience of drinking this stuff, what would you choose?
Well, so you've thrown me quite a few there at the same time, Stefan, because my favourite coffee probably, I always say, there's lots of diversity. It's a bit like asking somebody what their favourite wine is. If they're a wine connoisseur, you really like variety. However, if you put a bayonet to me and said, you've got one coffee left, I am probably going to get a coffee from Burundi or Rwanda. I'm going to get a natural red Bourbon and I'm going to brew it in my French press and I'm going to enjoy the fruitiness and it will take me back to the memories of being in Rwanda and Burundi and visiting coffee plants. So that's where I'm going to go.
And that's one of the great things about it. It's a whole experience, isn't it? It's not just the taste. It's a world.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, the French press is interesting. I'm not a fan of the French press. I call me old fashioned. But the different brewing methods create a very different flavour, don't they? Can you talk a little bit about that for us?
Yeah, and actually, I wouldn't call you old-fashioned. I'd probably call you newfangled. I mean, the French press, to me, the reason I like the French press is it produces almost what we might call dirty coffee. It's the closest to, you're putting water directly in contact with the coffee and basically infusing the coffee into it. So it creates a very high load of caffeine. It's quite soluble. it's giving you a lot of the coffee oils. Once you start, for example, putting coffee through filter, through any kinds of filters, really we're sort of beginning to filter out those oils and filter out those particles. So that changes the sense of the coffee. So if you like clean coffee, as opposed to dirty coffee, as it were, then, you know, you want to be using a filter method. So brewing does change all of that. The other thing, of course, is the length of time that it takes to brew. And that's the other consideration that you have to bring in. Everyone has their own recipes, but one of the fundamentals from the sort of the perspective of the industry is, of course, what happens when you add pressure. Because if you can add pressure, you can kind of reduce the brewing time. So the kind of the principle behind espresso and that kind of brewing is, in effect, that we've speeded up the time there. We achieve lots of other things with pressure, but that's its fundamental value.
And what about the heat of the water? Because the hotter the water, the more bitter the compounds that you'll create. So do you go for fresh boiled water? I mean, you're clearly a clean and serene kind of guy. Do you go for fresh boiled water, or do you let it stand for a few seconds first?
The general advice on brewing temperature for coffee is you want something about sort of 92 to 95 rather than 100. So in simple terms, the advice is boil your water, leave it for 30 seconds, and then add it to the coffee.
Yeah. Okay. Can you paint the picture of the journey of the bean itself? So coffee beans are seeds in a cherry growing on a bush. Can you explain a little bit more about it? Paint the picture of the stuff itself for us.
Okay, so the bush itself. So in the wild, coffee is what they would call an understory sort of bush cum tree. So it's a shrub, really. It grows under the big sort of trees in Ethiopia, in Africa. Quite a spindly thing. Probably left to its own devices, it would grow probably maybe to 40 feet, but we would probably, as an agricultural thing, try to keep pruning it and keeping it to about sort of 8 feet, something like that, so that it can easily be picked by hand. It has beautiful flowers, beautiful white flowers, and then it sets, as you say, a whole load of fruit, what are referred to as cherries. Technically, they're actually drupes. Within these, we have obviously the seeds. You have 2 seeds per cherry. So when you see your standard coffee bean, like the one that you were just putting through the flamethrower there, it usually has sort of, you know, a rounded face, as it were, and a flat face, and that's because those 2 parts of the bean, as it were, are facing each other. There are 2 seeds facing each other with inside the fruit. In terms of the fruit itself, generally speaking, coffee fruits are red. We wait till they achieve sort of a bright red state to harvest them.
And then the initial journey, I mean, this obviously way back in time, but how did coffee first become a drink? Do we know much about it, about its origins?
We know something of its origins, and some of it we have to sort of deduce, okay? So within the context of being in Ethiopia, of being in that area of the Horn of Africa, it was foraged primarily. It was foraged as a wild product. And when I say it, I'm thinking here about all elements of the plant. So they were using the leaves for producing a kind of tea. They would use the fruits to produce both foodstuffs. There's a sort of a kind of an energy bar that you can create using the sort of the cherries, or the dried cherries, but also that they would kind of start brewing things with the husks of those dried fruits. So once the things are really dried out. Now, it's that beverage that appears to start the kind of the road to coffee, in the sense that this is, as far as we can tell, begins to be imported, these dried fruits, into Arabia from about the 1450s. And at this point, they're being used to prepare a beverage there, which is commonly known as kisha, which essentially is sort of adding sort of hot water to these sort of dried, desiccated fruit. And it produces a much more, it's kind of a tea-like beverage. In fact, if you've ever experienced what's now called cascara, which is kind of coffee cherry, dry coffee cherry that can be used as teas, it's that kind of a beverage.
So this is without them being roasted?
At this stage, it's without them being roasted.
As you've said that, I have here a cup of unroasted coffee bean tea. Coffee tea, I suppose it would be.
Okay.
That I made earlier. I haven't tasted it yet, so I'll have a go right now. So this is basically, it's kind of a slurry where I've just ground up a lot of the green beans, the unroasted beans. So let's have a little taste. yeah, just, I mean, it's a tea, I guess. It's a, yeah. It's tisane. It's got some aromas to it. Slightly musky, but slightly flowery as well, I guess. I would enjoy that, I guess, if I'd chosen it. But seeing as I could have made that into a coffee, I'm not so keen.
I'm just trying to check whether you've actually used the skins of the fruit in that as well, Stefan, because that's...
So I've got the coffee, the beans with the husks on. But not the whole cherry.
Okay, yeah, but not the whole cherry.
Ah, that's what I've missed out.
So
there.
that's the difference. Yeah,
gotcha.
I mean, you are getting something that probably tastes like something that they might have well prepared in Ethiopia itself. But I think you're probably closer to a tea than what would be the case with Keisha, where you'd have that fruit coming through.
Mm-hmm. And have you tasted coffee leaf tea?
I have tasted something like coffee leaf tea. I've also tasted cascara quite frequently, which is the sort of, you know, with the dry cherry itself. The dry cherry drink is very interesting, and I can't entirely technically explain this for you. So although it is made of dried cherry, it supposedly would have less caffeine than using just the concentrate of the bean. Mm-hmm. But I find it quite buzzy. It's quite sweet, it's quite buzzy, it certainly has an effect on you. And that's, of course, what was attractive about it.
And Ethiopia has a lot of these substances. I mean, when I was in Ethiopia, we ate cat, not the four-legged animal, but K-H-A-T.
Oh, yes.
And again, the buzz was quite important. I actually had a strange allergic reaction to it at the time, but that's immaterial. That's not the point. Okay, so back to the journey of coffee. How does it move from Ethiopia? Do we know much about its journey from its origins?
I think the interesting thing, Stefan, there is, consciously or not, you've actually made the intro for me to this story, in the sense that what we understand from an Arabic manuscript from around the 1550s is that a Sufi leader called Al-Dubani, Sufis were using at this point cat in their ceremonials, if you like. They used that to enable them to sort of get into a meditative state to perform their mantras. They used to chant mantras. And there appears to have been a shortage of cat. And so Al-Dubani told his followers, well, you know, we could try importing this thing that I tried in Ethiopia, this beverage, which they call Keisha, which is made of the coffee cherry. So the coffee cherry begins to be imported into Yemen. It's adopted by the Sufis, and gradually it spreads through the Arabian Peninsula. It reaches Mecca, which obviously is a big site where many pilgrims would come from around the whole of the Islamic diaspora. And that way it becomes popular in its first sort of popularity, to the extent that by the 1550s in Yemen, we know that coffee starts being grown as a cultivated crop itself.
So do you think that the initial spread is the psychoactive nature of coffee more than the flavour?
Yes, undoubtedly. It's that psychoactive effect, it's that buzzy effect, and it's being used to produce that sort of induced combination of sort of slight headiness and psychoactivity that enables people to get into their dedication. So it's not really about flavour at that point, it's about function.
Yeah. And do we know much about the chemistry of earlier coffee beans? Would they have, because, I mean, we both had a coffee this morning. I wouldn't say I'm in a meditative state. I'm not hitting the mantras yet. Do you think that back in the day it had a different effect, or maybe that people were more susceptible to the caffeine that was inside it?
I suspect they're more susceptible because, I mean, we are now a very heavily caffeinated society. We're encountering caffeine in all kinds of ways that we don't even calculate, as well as the ones that we are aware of. So I think that this is a bit like your first time ever to hit caffeine. And also you're not hitting a lot of caffeine regularly. So, I mean, one thing that we do know about caffeine is that our bodies adapt to it, just in the way that alcohol. So, I mean, I guess the simple parallel would be if you think about when you have your first drink after you've maybe abstained for a month or two, and you think about how that suddenly hits you as very heavy, and then within a few weeks of drinking, you're probably not finding one glass of wine or whatever at all sort of transformative.
Yeah.
And this is really about the way that your body reacts and adapts to that.
Now, I visited Ethiopia, rural Ethiopia, and was part of a coffee ceremony. It wasn't pitched as a coffee ceremony. We were just going to have coffee, but it was a ceremony. There's no getting around it. We had three brews from the same beans. They were, first of all, they were sort of dry roasted in a pan, and then the chaff all sort of floats away from it, and then you have this one really, really strong brew. And it was very much a sort of perfunctory thing. It wasn't about there was no standing on ceremony, but it was a ceremony at the same time. Now, the Ethiopian coffee ceremony is renowned. Is the sort of the ceremonial nature of coffee important? You know, you talked about a religious aspect or quasi-religious aspect, and then there's the cultural aspects as well. I mean, have we built these things around coffee as just a set of excuses to drink it?
We have built a lot of sets of rituals around coffee, and one might put it the other way, that the coffee gives us the excuse for the ritual. And I think actually that's probably closer to the truth. Mm. I mean, the Ethiopian one is somewhat unusual in that because you are working from scratch, there is obviously quite a lot of time involved in preparing your coffee. So it almost has to become a bit of a ritual. Mm. Or have that element to it to make it...
I guess so, yes. It's got its own pace.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, my understanding of that is it's very bound up in ceremonies of hospitality, of ritual of kind of friendship, of sharing and so forth, giving,
and yeah, absolutely.
It says quite a lot about sort of family status and gender relations as well within that sort of the unit. You know, it's very much my understanding again is that that's very much always undertaken by women within that society. So
yeah,
and indeed intriguingly, as it happens, I mean, you will know this best than me, Stefan, but it's ironically, or however you want to see it, it's also one of the ways that women are able to get into entrepreneurship in Ethiopia, because you'll see that all the stands selling coffee in the street are always manned by women. You know, it's taken on those connotations. But again, I think, you know, as we look at consumption habits around coffee, particularly as we spread into sort of essentially consumer societies, we build our own rituals around coffee. And we use the occasion of coffee to create other forms of ceremony and other kind of relationships. I mean, and there's an odd one actually that's just come into my head in relation to that, which is I've read sort of investigations of 1950s, as it were, the Swami people, the what we would call Lapland originally. And apparently with, you know, you might have 20 cups of coffee prepared a day.
Heavens.
And again, this would be, these are roamers, obviously, they roam, kind of you have your coffee before you go out hunting, the men go out for a day pack hunting, the women prepare coffee when they come back, and then each people visit each other's tents taking coffee.
Mm.
So this becomes, you know, again, a way in which, if you like, group identity, collective identity, collective hospitality is reinforced.
And that's how civilizations have bound themselves together, and the human can thrive by having these tools with which we can interact better.
Exactly right, yes.
And when I was at university, you know, there was definitely a sense of it was a good, you know, it was a prime way to try and get a snog, you know, come over for a coffee or will you come up for a coffee? That was basically,
yeah.
Do you fancy a snog?
Yeah.
And no, I'm good for coffee was generally my what I got in reaction. No, I'm fine. Now, there are sort of vague comparisons with the history of chocolate here, aren't there? But chocolate was very much a wealthy person's drink to begin with, or cacao was. Is it the same with coffee? Was it a wealthy person's drink? Was it a refined affair, as I suppose it still is now?
Well, there's two different aspects there. Was it a refined person's affair? Definitely. And a wealthy drink, definitely. And I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, coffee, chocolate and tea all come in roughly the same 50-year period into Europe. So on all of those occasions, yes, it's quite an exotic and well-off person's drink, essentially. So that is the kind of the original nature of coffee. What we see with coffee on the European continent is what we see with tea in Britain. That's to say, this is the drink that spreads down into the industrial working classes. And the reason for that is, in a sense, because it provides this kind of ability to give yourself a hot meal without actually having to do much preparation. And to, if you sort of sling in sugar and milk, then you're creating, you know, a meal rather than just a sort of a hot beverage, you know.
That's more of a soup.
Exactly. And you know, and that's important because if you're, and, you know, we think some of the first people to probably drink coffee outside of that sort of elite group would have been weavers in the Low Countries. And of course, if you think about weaving and you're at your loom and you want to do piecework, so you certainly don't want to stop weaving. But if you start sort of necking coffee, and then, of course, you're probably keeping your production going and possibly even speeding it up whilst sustaining yourself and giving yourself that sort of chance of refueling. So that is the way that it's sort of diffuses down.
Yeah.
But that tends to be what happens in the Low Countries. It happens in France. So France, we see the, you know, the Parisian cafe, as it were, particularly in the 19th century, becomes very much an institution for, you know, that covers all classes, let's say, that not necessarily the all classes in the same institution, but rather that that you have different cafes for catering for each.
Yeah. Now, I've messed up the chronology here a little bit by throwing us ahead too far. So let's just roll back a second and work out what happens when coffee arrives in Europe and then in London. How does that unfold?
Coffee arrives into Europe probably around the 1600s, possibly a little bit earlier. We suspect there was coffee certainly in Venice earlier. I've been trying to chase down recently the exact timing of that, but it's almost certain that that would be the case because you would have merchants from the Ottoman Empire, you know, trading into Venice and merchants being themselves in Venice. So there used to be a story that sort of, you know, the first record we have of coffee in Europe of that period is when an Ottoman trader is murdered in Venice and they find coffee in his possessions. From the sort of the first half of the 1600s, we see those great trading companies, the various Indian trading companies, East India companies as they're known across each of the major European states, beginning to try and get into the coffee trade, which is all going through the ports of Mocha and Hodeidah in Yemen. And at first, they're really using that coffee not to take to Europe, but to trade for other goods as they go sort of around the trade routes into the East. But coffee begins to arrive in Europe. It's used primarily as a sort of a medicinal compound. So, you know, you would buy coffee from the apothecary.
It's a tonic.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's not until really the 1650s that we get coffee houses that are really social places. And interestingly, this is, you know, this is the great British moment in coffee history, because actually in terms of the coffee house as a social place serving coffee, the first coffee house that we can really genuinely document is in London in 1652, 54, depending on your the way you wish to date this. But there's a guy selling coffee to drink from 1652. The man's name is Pasqua Rose. Now, Pasqua Rose's story is not an uncommon one, in that he, like many of the other pioneers of coffee within Europe in terms of opening coffee houses and so forth, is himself, basically what he is a so-called Armenian. But Armenian here really means a Christian within the context of the Ottoman Empire. So usually someone from that sort of Christianized areas who have come into Europe, bring with them their coffee knowledge, and then prepare coffee in the sort of the traditional way, essentially the sort of, you know, the Turkish way. Mm. That's really how coffee starts. Now, I mentioned the coffee houses bit because the interesting thing there is that really the regulations, which are much stronger in Europe, the guild regulations, mean that places where you might have expected to find coffee houses before the UK are much more resistant to allowing coffee to move from what can be sold by the apothecary to what can be served. Whereas our regulations, particularly in the 1650s, when we're in the period of the Civil War, everything is breaking down. It's no coincidence that that's the period when the guild regulations are lax, when it's difficult to enforce distinctions, and therefore it becomes easier to open coffee houses.
So it's a rebellious drink. Well, certainly in business terms, it's rebellious. But also, you know, it's a very political drink, isn't it?
It's a very political drink.
Because those coffee houses are associated with sort of political thought.
Yes. And I mean, intriguingly, it's a political drink on both sides of the divide. So the London coffee houses are indeed at the forefront of the revolution, as it were. They're sort of Cromwellian, they parliamentary debates and so forth. At the same time, we see the opening of coffee houses in Oxford, which is the other place that often claims that it has the first coffee house, which are very much as royalist centres. Mm-hmm. And this is quite interesting because in the aftermath of the Civil War with the Restoration, Charles II on the throne, Charles II at least twice tries to ban coffee houses, and he wants to ban them because they're places where he thinks his opponents are gathering and plotting against him and so forth. And someone has to point out to him that actually his own supporters also really appreciated coffee shops and are still using them. And, you know, this is not going to fly. It would be wise to forget this, which is exactly what happens.
Yeah. Now, I mean, we know a lot about slavery in chocolate and cocoa. Tell us a little bit about slavery in terms of the coffee industry, both back in the day when it was first being exported, and you know, why that persists today.
As you say, you know, with all of those commodity crops, so chocolate, sugar in particular, and coffee, all during the 18th century are essentially plantation grown crops using slave labour. So in the case of coffee, as coffee is moved to the Caribbean in the 18th century, and it is very much grown alongside sugar using exactly those methods of plantation slavery. The first place that it becomes very strong actually is Suriname. Mm. The Dutch introduce a slave system there. We see in what is now Haiti, which was at the time known as Saint-Domingue, which became the kind of the leading French-owned coffee producing nation in the 18th century, coffee producing origin, excessive, massive use of slavery there. And we see it across really the Caribbean, the British in Jamaica, the Spanish in Cuba and so forth. Haiti is a fascinating and very distressing example in that Haiti is, of course, the first place where we have a slave rebellion. It's actually inspired by the French Revolution. Many of the people who are in the coffee business, and this is a quite complex thing, of course, within the society. So within Haiti, within Saint-Domingue, quite a number of the coffee farm owners are themselves mixed race and join a revolt to effectively assert what they consider to be their rights. And there is then a very confused period where they also are joined up with slaves fighting for their liberty. But to cut to the chase, so for example, Toussaint Louverture, the Haitian leader, who was a mixed race person, at one point rented a coffee farm and rented therefore with that about 13 slaves. That's sort of the standard structure of the time. Gradually, of course, we know that this trade is abolished in the 19th century, but we still see massive labour abuses. And the reason for that really is coffee picking in particular needs a large labour force. The rest of the year, not so much, but the harvest season undoubtedly. So there are all kinds of ways in which that labour force can be recruited or quite frequently coerced. So we see a lot in Central America, for example, where the indigenous populations are effectively coerced into working or providing labour onto newly established coffee plantations. And in relation to modern slavery and conditions today, a lot of that revolves around the recruitment of pickers. So the use of children, the use of very badly paid labour or poorly compensated or poorly treated labour usually is about that harvesting period.
Yeah. And just to go back to the Haitian problem, one of the most egregious parts of that is that after the rebellion, the French extracted reparations from Haiti for hundreds of years afterwards, which is just the most disgusting concept that, you know, that despite the fact that they had enforced slavery for years and tortured the you know, so much of the populace, they then made them pay for it. It just beggars belief.
It's absolutely shocking. And anyone who wants to understand why Haiti's economy is the way that it is, there's your answer.
So let's get back to the drink itself. So when back in the coffee houses in the 1650s, what was the stuff? You mentioned a Turkish coffee style. So basically coffee beans dropped into hot water, drunk still with the beans at the bottom? Grounds at the bottom, sorry.
The grounds at the bottom, yes. Essentially sort of made in that Turkish way. So that I think the key thing to say about the Turkish sort of development of coffee is that's where we move from a relatively sort of light roast, almost toasting of the beans that we would see in Arabia to this very dark concentrated coffee and concentrating solely on the bean. We're not now using the skin at all. We're not using the husk. And I think that's partly about transportation methods. It's about efficiency. And what it ends up, therefore, is yes, you know, coffee that looks like coffee that we would recognize as coffee today, albeit brewed in that traditional Turkish manner. Very dark, sludgy.
Yeah,
would be what you were getting.
Serious flavour and generally sweetened. I would have thought to counteract the bitterness.
Yeah, we think possibly not at the very beginning, but soon afterwards would be the answer. So I think, you know, probably in the 1650s, maybe not, but by the time you're reaching even the sort of the 1700s, yes, definitely sweetened. And with the beginnings of the addition of milk.
Okay, now, okay, this, I was terrified to even bring the concept up with you, Jonathan.
Okay, yeah.
But let's talk about the milk. So I have to admit, the first two coffees I have in the day are lattes.
Oh dear.
I know there's not a lot of coffee flavour in it, but I have to ease myself in. But after lunch, I'm caning the espressos, very sweet and very strong. But what was the thing about milk? Why was milk added to coffee? And when did the cappuccino first really crop up?
Why was milk first added? Two reasons. One is definitely as a sweetener. And the other is because in a sense, it's also a freshener. And it allows us to think that there are elements of the drink. You know, some of the drink is very exotic. Some of the drink becomes very domestic. So café au lait, for example, in France became popular partly because people thought, well, OK, we're now adding French milk. And we're kind of, you know, we're turning this kind of slightly esoteric thing into a French thing.
Turn it into a French drink.
And so there's that element to it. There is the element, I mean, I think we have to be real when you roast coffee darkly, when you've got pretty stale coffee. I wouldn't have thought this coffee was the best tasting coffee, so you would probably want something to mitigate it. Mm-hmm. Sort of, you know, milk obviously provides the reason there. Now the cappuccino is a slightly separate thing, and from the cappuccino we can then go to your latte problem, Stefan. But the cappuccino is interesting because the origins of the cappuccino are really Austrian. You know, it's a cappuccino. And what this is at this point is just black coffee with ordinary milk. But there is a cappuccino because that creates this kind of, you know, brown coffee that equates in colour terms to the robe of the Capuchin monk. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like a colour indication. You'll know that sort of...
Like a noisette.
Yes, exactly. And that's really the point, is almost like, you know, by telling your server that you want a cappuccino, you're telling what balance between milk and coffee you require.
Gotcha.
Now, that seems to have gone, obviously, through Habsburg Empire. At that point, places like Trieste were part of the empire, so it becomes popular in Trieste. The frothing part only begins to arrive once we get the original espresso machines, which have these steam ones on them. And so the story of espresso, the first machines really for the first half of the 20th century, it's not that they have a great pressure. They're really sort of steam-driven machines. They're about sort of using the power of steam and really kind of no more than a couple of atmospheres of pressure. But you use the steam, so you've got steam in the boiler, so you can also use that steam, let it off directly into other drinks, because most of these are in cocktail bars, so you create your kind of hot toddies with your steam wand. Somebody obviously, you know, in that period started using the steam wand to also prepare the milk, and in a sense, you know, start therefore the whole kind of move towards frothing of milk. There's a wonderful account of a guy called Domenico Parisi, who has a coffee bar in New York in the 20s and 30s. And there's this account of him sort of steaming milk, and it sounds like a dive bomber coming out of the skies. You know, that it's just so you can imagine how much air he was putting into it. But the final piece, of course, is that the cappuccino doesn't become a drink like that which we know today until the 50s, because until you can have an espresso with the concentrate, the high concentrate, high pressure brewing that we have today, sort of the 9 atmospheres plus, you didn't have an espresso with a head of crema on it. You had really more like a sort of slightly concentrated filter. So that test of, you know, the cappuccino as we know it today is really a 1950s drink in terms of that would be how far back we would go and actually recognize the thing. The latte, if I can just finish on this one, because I feel there is more to say about this. No, the latte is interesting because the latte is the sweetened version further of the cappuccino in a sense. And it's developed really as a beverage in those sort of international coffee chains, of which, you know, the most famous one is obviously Starbucks. It's developed as a kind of, you know, here is a way for you to drink a beverage that's got a lot of sweetness, but nonetheless has a good kick of coffee in it because you've got the underlying espresso. So it's an alternative to that. It's not really a drink you encounter in Italy itself. In Italy, if you were to ask for a cafe latte, it's really something more that you would make as a kind of domestic drink where you kind of boil your milk and your coffee up in a saucepan.
And just apologise as you ask for it. Now, we need to talk about two last things. We're really running out of time because this is just far too interesting. But very quickly, just tell us a little bit about Brazil and its importance in the modern coffee industry.
Yeah, so Brazil's importance is that it is the dominant coffee producer in the world, and it has been since about the 1870s. And indeed, you know, it reaches its peak actually relatively early in the early 1900s. So in the 1900s, 1906, I think most famously, Brazil grew about 80% plus of the world's coffee. I mean, that it's enormous. Now it would be probably closer to about 40%. But the Brazil's dominance in the coffee industry is absolutely defining for what coffee is and how the coffee industry works. The Brazilian market, well, you know, basically, if you want to understand how your price of coffee works, the price of your green coffee, it essentially, the biggest factor in determining that is the forecast of how much coffee was going to come out of Brazil each year. And the coffee price, as you probably know, is extremely volatile. So when Brazil has a high harvest, or a high couple of harvests, then the price of coffee plummets because there's so much coffee available. And that can leave people in deep distress in other countries. When
so much of your economy is predicated on one particular crop, that can be devastating.
Well, exactly. So I mean, I was talking about Burundi when we started, and Burundi at one point would have had 70%. It's probably about 50 now, but at one point it was about 70% plus of its exports would have been coffee. So, you know, if the Brazilian harvest is a good one, then Burundi is in big trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the way that it works. Brazil itself, you know, its achievement was always to produce coffee cheaply. And originally it does that by just expanding more and more into, as it were, virgin land and just sort of doing things that are ecologically disastrous, as we now see in other crops, you know, the kind of, you know, slash and burn, plant up for 20 years when the land starts losing its fertility, move on. So that element of Brazil also needs to be thought about. But Brazil's dominance in the position is such that Brazil basically determines what happens in the world coffee market.
Yeah. Okay, now we need to end really by looking at the modern coffee industry, really, and what we've learned from the history of coffee. How do we tackle this one? I mean, is there, Do you think we've reached peak coffee shop? That's one issue that's cropped up over the last few years. I mean, I love a coffee shop. I write all my best work in my favourite cafe on the side of the park down the road. But also, are there products? You know, the food industry is constantly trying to squeeze more money out of the commodities that it's got. Do you see new elements evolving, and do you see the way that we drink coffee, certainly in things like coffee shops, changing?
So that was not so much a question as an invitation to write about three theses, wasn't it? Earlier you were asking about, you know, was coffee a sort of, a kind of democratized drink? And of course, the developments of coffee over most of history were to kind of make it cheaper, to make it more accessible, to make it more everyday. And of course, it has become a very much an everyday drink. But what's happened perhaps in the last 30, 40 years is that we've seen this other element of the industry develop, where coffee comes repositioned as more again a sort of a lifestyle drink, a connoisseur style drink. And that's what I think has really driven, you know, is what the coffee shop is about in a sense. It's this representation of coffee as a sort of a premium product, and a product that you can build a business format around again. And that's the sort of the great change. Now, I suppose if we think about the future, the thing that's interesting is obviously coffee has big issues around climate change. There's a study that suggests that traditional coffee growing areas, maybe only 50% of them would be viable if we carry on at current trends by sort of 2050.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do about that? You know, I mean, some things create some sort of weird outcomes. So we now have coffee growing in Sicily and in Southern California. But I, you know, the what is interesting to me is more the way that some of the old coffee species that we discounted because they weren't particularly productive or they grew in the wrong areas are now coming back into play. So we have a coffee from West Africa called Coffea stenophyllia that's just been sort of almost rediscovered, that it now looks as if we could breed that in with our traditional Coffea arabica to create a more heat-resistant type of coffee. Oh. So there are ways in which those old elements of coffee that we discarded as we kind of converged around a couple of species, the use of a couple of species and the sort of, you know, concentrating towards the domestic, will actually sort of come back into play, and partly come back into play because we now put a bigger value, at least socially, on coffee. Yeah. You know, whether we can translate that into enough value to keep the coffee industry growing at source, which is what one would hope. You know, those are the big challenges, I guess, with the industry. And your final question was, are we at peak coffee shop? And I'd just say, in the now 15 years plus that I've been in this business, every year someone calls peak coffee shop, and it's never yet happened. So I'm certainly not going to be calling it.
Thank God for that, because I love them. Okay, we have to end it there. You're just too damn interesting, Jonathan. Thank you so much for that. Your knowledge has been given with such good grace, and I really appreciate it. Jonathan Morris, thank you so much for joining me.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the Food Matters Live podcast on your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, please give us a review. Thank you so much for listening.